This evening we'll move on to consider the parami of equanimity. And this word really means finding balance. Yeah? So how do we find balance in a world of change? And one of the themes that we've been exploring all week really is this idea of the flow, and the flux of life, things coming, things going. So the question is, how do we find a stillness and a peace and a freedom within such a world? The very basic meditation instructions that we began with right on the very first day and that we've been working with throughout really, being aware of the breathing, noticing that things can draw us away, coming back to the breath, really is a training in equanimity. Yeah. Whatever else is happening, whatever emotional storms are passing through, whatever thoughts are there, whatever bodily sensations are there, we come back to the breath. So it's a real training in a kind of stability within change, a stillness within change. That whatever's happening, there's somewhere to come home to. And that gives us a flavour of this quality of equanimity. Equanimity helps us to deal with an uncertain world. I don't know if any of you have come across John Peacock, the teacher John Peacock, but he has a nice phrase. He says, relax, nothing's under control. So it's the kind of ease that acknowledges that, that acknowledges life is really to its very core uncertain, unpredictable, profoundly uncontrollable. In some ways, the issues that challenge our equanimity feel very contemporary. Financial crisis. Certainly in England, I don't know if it's the same here, but you know, a lot of things about public spending cuts and recessions and banking crises. The particular contemporary challenge of ecological damage, environmental issues that we face. So a lot of the issues that challenge our equanimity are very contemporary. But they're also perennial, they're also ongoing, they're also timeless. Old age, sickness, being subject to death, losing people we love, living in a world where we don't always get what we want, and we're faced with things that we don't want. So both in terms of current issues and in terms of something about the structure of life, this quality of equanimity is called for. So living with an uncertain world, living in an uncertain world, helps to help us do this. We have to really look at this expectation of security that we have. And I mentioned this little example in the talk the other day about, you know, my bus pass and expecting even a little thing like that to be reliable and being somewhat surprised when it didn't work one day. Stephen Batchelor's got another example of just the ephemeral nature of the world. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with Stephen, but he, as well as being a Dharma teacher, is a very keen photographer. And he describes how he was in a beautiful place one day, or saw a particular picture that he wanted to take. And perhaps he didn't have his camera with him. And he thought, okay, I'll come back tomorrow and take this picture. And of course, by the time he came back tomorrow, the light had changed, or the air was different, or the weather was different, and the particular configuration he'd wanted to capture was gone. You know, to me, this is quite interesting, actually, because you know, at certain times I think of photography as a you know, an attempt to somehow fix things, that there is a world of change and we take the picture and we've somehow got it. But here was an example about using that kind of art form to really draw attention to ephemerality. I don't know if you're interested in taking pictures, but it makes you very sensitive to light, shifts of light, changes of light. Just how changeable the appearance of things is. You know, I mean, we tend to think something like this book has an appearance that's part of its reality. But you know, if I move it closer to the light, that changes. If I subtly change the angle, it changes. You know, if I turn off the lights altogether, it's very difficult to see at all. You know. So the things we can cling to, what I look like, what you look like, you know, it's all very dependent on these shifting and uncertain things like the quality of light, to name just one factor. So we feel sometimes that we're expecting certainty, we're expecting permanence, and yet the world continually reminds us of change and uncertainty. Equanimity raises the question of whether impermanence is intrinsically painful, or whether it is simply our relation to it, our relationship to it, our reaction, our response to it. Even death, which has really got to be the biggest sign of impermanence of all, equanimity teaches us it is possible to make peace with this. Yeah? It is possible to make peace with that. I don't know if you've, you know, had experiences of that in your own grieving or your own bereavements. But yeah, there's a deep loss, a deep mourning and a profound sadness. But within that, at times, and it's not always easy and it's not always immediate, but at times there can be a peace with that. But yeah, we love the person who's gone. But somehow on the deepest level we can sense it's okay. It's okay. You know, and it's a journey to get to that point, and it's not something to impose on ourselves as a kind of demand that we should feel like that. But it's just a sense of possibility that even the most profound impermanence that human beings face can be looked at, and we can make peace with it. It is possible. It seems to me, when I think about my own life, the really difficult times in my life, or the times of real struggle, really, and not necessarily the times of the greatest sorrow, but it seems to me they're the times of the greatest disconnection. Yeah. Again, if you're sensitive to this, it's an interesting thing to explore. When we're lost in something trivial, we're lost in some kind of reaction, or we feel that we're spinning round and round and round in some semi-conscious pattern, we really notice that. That kind of situation is much more... there's much more of a struggle there than even a profound loss that's met. That's met. It really begins to shift our perspective of where the struggle is in life. Is it in events? Or is it in that disconnection from events? So equanimity includes making peace with loss. And making peace with gain. The word dukkha is a central word in Dharma teachings, roughly translates as suffering or unsatisfactoriness. There are two really important ways in which this word is used. In the first meaning means something like suffering, as I said. But the second meaning is unreliable. Unreliable. I mean, obviously it's a related meaning. And Dharma teaching is all conditioned things are dukkha. So what does that mean? I mean, this bowl is a conditioned thing. This bell is a conditioned thing. So say it's dukkha, suffering. Well, I mean, it appears to me, at least, that this particular piece of metal is not suffering. It doesn't have that capability. So what does it mean to say it's suffering? This is a conditioned thing. It's a wonderful book on loving kindness. Yeah, it's conditioned. So according to that teaching, it's dukkha. So what does it mean? This is where that second meaning of unreliable is really important. And what it means by unreliable is unreliable in an absolute sense. Obviously, relatively speaking, both of these things have a kind of reliability to them. But it's not a permanent home. It's not the source of our freedom. Anything conditioned. If I see this bell as the source of my freedom, one of you sees it as the source of your freedom, we're going to have a little bit of conflict. If this is the source of my freedom and I leave it on the plane, happen to my freedom. Yeah? So as much as these things are valuable, useful, wonderful things, they're not an ultimate refuge. Yeah, they're not an ultimate place to come home to. So I've got this image which I feel is useful. If you think about a bike, a bicycle, with a broken wheel, right? Can that cause you any suffering? The only way that is a problem is if you jump on it and try and get somewhere. Yeah? If you ride a bike with a broken wheel, you're going to fall off. But if you don't try and ride the bike, it's okay, it's just the bike with a broken wheel. No problem. And that too is, an interesting reflection on a wise response to impermanence or an equanimous response to impermanence. It's only when we're asking too much of things that they become suffering, they become that unreliability comes to life. Yeah? The bell is a bell, it's fine. Peaceful. It's only when it becomes something that is kind of everything to me, if I were to project that into it, that it becomes suffering. So the equanimous heart, the heart of equanimity, knows not to project too much onto that which is conditioned. The Buddha speaks of the 8 vicissitudes. We might call the 8 ups and downs, really. Pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. So equanimity really is about acknowledging that these are the fundamental features of our life, these are fundamental visitors, and equanimity offers the possibility of coming to terms with all of those changes, being still within all of those changes, greeting all of those changes. Equanimity too knows that no condition can make us immune from that. No amount of money, no job, no relationship, no living situation can somehow in itself pull us out of pleasure, pain, gain, loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. I don't know. Forgive me if it's too trivial an example for you, but it's the one in my mind at the moment. I don't know, if I think of footballers in the English Premier League, you know, they're doing things that so many people would dream of, so many children would dream of doing that kind of thing, and, you know, wealth and fame beyond the imagination. But, you know, one only needs to look at their lives in, you know, the smallest bit of detail to realize that, you know, they're faced with all of these things. Pleasure, pain, gain, loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. So even though all those childhood dreams have been realized, you know, it's not pulled them out of this basic human situation. Sharon Salzberg gives a lovely example of her experiences with equanimity, which I shall share with you. She says, some years ago, Joseph Goldstein and I went to Calcutta to visit one of our teachers, Deepa Ma. She was elderly and it seemed important to see her as soon as possible. As it happened, the only time we could visit was between teaching retreats on our way from one in Sweden to another in Australia. This meant we would arrive in India during the monsoon season. The day after we got there, we went straight to Deepa Ma's home and stayed with her for the day. Outside, it was raining torrentially, but I was so happy to be with Deepa Ma again that I paid no attention to the tremendous downpour. When we left her at dusk and went down to the street, we discovered what happens in Calcutta after a long period of torrential rain. The sewers flood, overflow and pour through the streets. Sewage mixed with rainwater was flowing, perhaps 3 feet deep, past the front of the house. We stood on the step looking at that extraordinary scene. Since cabs and rickshaws couldn't move through such a flood, we would have to walk back to our hotel. Joseph, who's quite a bit taller than I am, commented, "This should be interesting." I thought, well, yeah, if you're 6'3", it may be interesting. If you're my height, this is not going to be so interesting. We stepped off into the flood. It was absolutely horrible to be wading through that, the depth of it, the stench, things brushing against my legs in the twilight. When the sewers overflow in Calcutta, the rats are forced out as well, and they filled the streets. Desperate, drowning rats bumped against my legs as we sloshed along. All of my senses, including my mind, were being assaulted by terrible, vile experiences. 4 or 5 days later, we arrived in Australia. A friend had gotten us tickets to a symphony at the Sydney Opera House, which is a splendid architectural marvel built right on the ocean harbour. Before the concert, she took us out to dinner at one of those elegant restaurants that perch high above a city and revolve as you eat. Sydney is a very beautiful place, and we enjoyed lovely, sweeping vistas of it as we savoured the meal of many delicious and well-presented courses. At the concert, everyone was clean, smelling very nice, and beautifully dressed. As we sat there listening to the wonderful music of Dvorak and Brahms, taking in pleasures through every sense door, I remembered Calcutta. What had happened to that reality? In 6 months, even in 1 day or 1 hour, we can experience so many extremes of pleasure and pain. The question is, how can a human heart, my heart or your heart, absorb the continual unremitting contrast of this life without feeling shattered and without thinking we cannot bear it? Battered by changes, the heart mind can become brittle, rigid. It can wither and shrink. The Buddha said that our hearts can wilt as a flower does when it has been out in the sun too long. Have you ever encountered this feeling? How can we live with such vicissitudes? How can we hold them all with some sense of wholeness, coherence, harmony? Can we actually experience freedom in the midst of all of these immense changes as they roll through our lives over and over again? Can we actually be happy in this continuous arising and passing away? So we can see there then that this equanimity is a mind that can open to the fact that there's beautiful things in the world, there's difficult, ugly things in the world. There's pleasure, there's pain. And somehow greet the whole thing. One thing that really helps us with equanimity is to move towards a more steady view. Yeah? And that means letting go of a wildly changing or a wildly fluctuating picture of the nature of the world. So we're letting go of that tendency to think, oh, one minute the world's brilliant, this is an amazing world, this is, you know, everything in it is going to plan and it's full of pleasure and wonderful things. And the next minute thinking, this is a terrible world, this is a cruel, harsh place and I wish I'd never been born, and that kind of thing. Yeah. So the equanimous mind is, you know, the view is more steady. So in the floods in Calcutta, the view is steady. In the beautiful concert hall in Sydney, the view is steady. That really seems to me to be an aspect of wise view. Yeah, an aspect of wise view. That's where really that teaching on the eight vicissitudes I think is really helpful, because that's a wise way to look at the world. If we want to make any generalization about the kind of world we live in, it's not bad to say it's a world with pleasure, pain, gain, loss, praise, blame, fame and disrepute. So when we're greeted with one of those things, we're not grasping that as a picture of the totality. Another thing that helps develop the equanimous mind is to reflect that things are rarely as bad or as good as we imagine. Yeah? Imagination tends to exaggerate both the negative and the positive qualities of things. So, when we think of something that might be really good, yeah, let's say that we want a new job and we go for a job and it's the job that we've wanted for some time and we get that job. Now, equanimity is not saying, you know, kind of don't get pleased about that or don't feel happy about that or anything else. But it's just knowing that the new thing, the good thing that's come into our lives, you know, we'll have a shadow side too. And that's okay, that's not to kind of crush it or push it down. But just knowing that. So then there's that steadiness. So we're not so surprised when, you know, after so many weeks or months, the more difficult aspects of the dream job begin to appear. The same way something that's a really painful or difficult experience in our life can have hidden opportunities. Yeah, I have to tread carefully here, not to, you know, deny the pain in these things. But for example, a person going through a divorce. I mean, clearly, you know, on the face of that, that's a painful thing, and the reality is, it's a painful thing. But it's not unusual to hear people say that even in the midst of that pain, new opportunities appeared. One thing was ending and that it did make room for new beginnings. Yeah. So if some of the things that we want so much, like the new job, have the side that's not so good, and some of the things that we fear and hope are not going to happen have some of the positive qualities, again we can begin to sense that equanimity. Yeah, the other side of the coin, if we, you know, we get married, on the face of it, a wonderful thing and a good thing, and again, that's very true. But even these positive changes bring challenges, yeah? And a new situation brings you know, time to get used to that. Time to, you know, move beyond the honeymoon period, quite literally. And that means seeing the reality of something. Yeah, the reality of something. Equanimity is a very real quality. Yeah, it's a quality that sees clearly. Some of the heavens and hells we can create in our life are born of fantasy. The fantasy that this is wonderful forever. Or this is awful forever. Yeah? So equanimity, knowing that nothing is forever. Nothing is wholly wonderful or wholly terrible. You know, develops that stillness and that balance. Got another story which illustrates this particular point about the hidden costs of good events and the hidden benefits of so-called bad events. A man living on the border of China cherished his stallion above all else in his life. One day his horse escaped and was captured by the nomads across the border. Everyone tried to console him, but his father only said, "What makes you so sure this isn't a blessing?" Some months later, his stallion returned home, bringing with him a mate. The man was overjoyed at his good fortune, but his father only said, "What makes you so sure this isn't a disaster?" Riding his new horse one day, he fell and broke his hip, and was once more lost in despair. His father asked, "What makes you so sure this isn't a blessing?" Soon after, the nomads invaded the village and forced every able-bodied man into their army. The father and his son were spared this fate. Caught in the tangle of our preferences and judgments, friends and enemies, there is little ease to be found in the world. We will find simplicity in our lives only when we find it within our minds. Just as the mind is the forerunner of confusion and complexity, it is also the forerunner of ease and well-being. So equanimity knows that. It's the mind, really the mind that brings peace and well-being. The mind which creates confusion and struggle. So seeing that, we're not so caught with events. Not projecting so much into events. Equanimity is a quality which includes warmth. Yeah, includes warmth. It's not a cold indifference, as I think I mentioned the other day. It's not like becoming, you know, a piece of wood, totally unaffected by the world. Somewhat dead, really. Yeah. So when we talk about, you know, non-attachment or letting go of clinging to things being a particular way, we're not talking about a kind of totally, completely disengaged transcendental realm at all. It's one of the paradoxes of spiritual life, I think. Equanimity is a quality that comes close to life, is touched by life, feels life. And yet there's a stillness within that contact. Many teachers say that the opposite of attachment is not so much detachment, but engagement. That's precisely that. Letting go of too much of our own agenda that allows a real response with the world. I remember asking Christina Feldman actually once about, how she'd founded Gaia House. And, along with Christopher Titmuss, together they founded Gaia House. And I mean, to me, I have to say, I think it's an extraordinary achievement. Yeah, extraordinary achievement to really set something like that up from nothing. And, a place that's benefited so many people. And she said something about a kind of, it's an inner stillness that really allows wise activity. Yeah. So the stillness and equanimity we're talking about is not a passive thing, it's not something that doesn't engage with the world. And again, just one example, you know, setting up such a centre as that. A really wise engagement with the world. Another example of the way equanimity is not a cold quality comes to mind when I think of the Dalai Lama. And again, you only need to kind of picture him or think of him. I mean, this is not a cold person. This is a person with a lot of heart. He once apparently was hearing some accounts of the conditions of nuns in monasteries. I think in Tibet rather than in exile in India. But that there were particularly poor conditions that nuns were practicing in and weren't having the same benefits really that they should have done, you know, compared to the monks. And you know, this story reduced him to tears. Yeah, he's deeply moved by that, and then wanting to respond, wanting to do something about it. So equanimity is still a quality that can. We can be touched by life. I also think of the Tibetan sand mandalas, if you know those. They make these beautiful pictures in the sand, really wonderful pictures, which they can then dissolve, you know. So it's still this sense of, yes, the world is changing, there's impermanence there, but there's also care and beauty within all of that. It's not a reason not to care or not to engage. So meditation practice in general, equanimity in particular, is definitely not about the end of motivation. Yeah? It's not about losing motivation. And sometimes people ask about this, well, you know, what if I'm supposed to be letting go of all these cravings and thirsts and desires? How am I going to ever do anything? You know, it's not about the end of motivation, but it's about a shift in motivation from motives based around greed, and ill will, delusion, towards a motivation rooted in wisdom and compassion. So it's a transformation of motivation. Does equanimity make it appear that things matter more? Or that things matter less? I find that a really interesting question. Does equanimity make it appear that things matter more? Or that things matter less? And to me, there's a deep paradox here again, which illuminates something about the fruits of meditation practice. Because I think there is a sense in which equanimity means that things that we used to be bothered about, we're not so bothered about so much. So equanimity implies less neurotic worrying, a more accepting attitude to the changes in life. If we think about the father in that story, you know, when his son falls off the horse and injures himself, the equanimity in a sense is, he is not so caught up in that. There's also a sense that equanimity feeds into a care and sensitivity, so that simultaneously things matter more. You know, every moment is saturated with presence, significance. And I think about some of the ways that Zen practitioners work, and if you go into a Zen hall, that you put your shoes very, very neatly outside, you know. So there's a sense that this matters, you know, taking care of that. just kind of throwing the shoes down, but just very carefully putting things. A classic kind of mindfulness story of drinking the tea again, you know, that, yeah, this is to be valued and appreciated. So maybe we could say equanimity helps us to care more and be caught up less. To care more, be caught up less. Ajahn Chah, who's a great teacher of letting go, I think also touches upon this point. He's, you know, letting go is a very strong theme in his teaching. And once I think he was talking to somebody practicing in his monastery who was sitting in his meditation hut and with a leaky roof and water was coming in and, you know, there was full of water everywhere. And, you know, Ajahn Chah said to him, you know, what are you doing? There's water coming in your hut. You're not going to do it. Oh, I'm letting go. I'm letting go. I'm letting go. He said, oh, you know, some people just don't understand, you know. So it was a sort of, you know, he really didn't mean that. He really didn't mean letting go as in, you know, stop fixing the roof. I'm afraid I probably fell into that extreme myself once when I was doing a long retreat in Wales many years ago, and I was just in a little kind of room at the top of a place and the light bulb went, and I'm afraid to say I got used to sitting in the dark, you know, rather than just changing this light bulb. But you know, if the light bulb goes, change it. Yeah? It's not about being equanimous with the fact that it's gone and not doing anything about it. Yeah, I mean, another example, Ajahn Sumedho, you know, again, obviously a student of Ajahn Chah, and he's teaching about this equanimous mind. And he says, if you're sitting there in the meditation hall and, you know, the door's banging in the wind or something, you know, then get up and shut the door, you know. That's also part of this. So not to kind of put this accepting as some kind of idol, really, yeah. This kind of accepting, not turning that into passivity. In practicing with equanimity, we begin to limit the attempt to fix and control the conditions of the world. And there's more emphasis on the quality of the sensitivity we bring into the world. There's more emphasis on the relationship to things. That deep, profound, intimate connection which is not bound up with things. And just to finish, I thought it's also helpful to be equanimous about one's own reactions to things. Yeah? But not to turn the teaching on equanimity into some kind of oppressive perfectionism. Where, you know, I've got to be equanimous all the time, and, you know, as soon as you see something that, you know, is not so equanimous, you kind of, oh no, no, I've lost my equanimity. But we can actually be, as strange as it sounds, be equanimous about our lack of equanimity at times. Yeah? There are times when we don't feel so balanced, and times when we do get a bit carried away, and times when we are a bit caught up with things. Well, you know, that happens too. And that's fine. And, you know, bringing an acceptance to that. I had an experience a few months ago, I think, where I was on quite a crowded train, and I was getting up to get off the train, and I don't think I was too sure if the person in front of me was going to get off the train or not. So I don't really know what I did, but I probably stood a little bit too close to him and gave him the impression that I was sort of, you know, wanting him to get off the train. And he turned around to me and said something, I can't remember what it was exactly, but it was like, oh, you know, hang on mate, I'm getting off as well, you know. It was a little bit sort of you know, telling me off really for what he was perceiving as my lack of patience. And, you know, I probably felt that as a little bit harsh. And so, you know, there's a kind of reaction. Okay, and you can feel it. The heart beats a bit more quickly and, you know, thinking, oh, maybe I was a bit impatient. You know, what's going on? That kind of thing. And it seems to me that equanimity in that moment is being open to that reaction too, being equanimous with that too, with sensitive beings that are affected by what's happening. And then that's just another reaction that arises, passes in its own time. And I certainly know from other experiences, it's not helpful to say, you know, don't react, don't react, don't react, you know, trying to put a lid on it. You know, so equanimity includes being peaceful with the times when we do lose our balance. And you know, coming back to this analogy with the breath meditation, it's why it's such a beautiful meditation. We wander off and we come back. And we wander off and we come back again and again and again. And it's a real metaphor for life. Yeah. So maybe we can see equanimity as being like the breath. It's an anchor point, it's a base, it's a refuge. Times will wander off, yeah, but we can always come back and we can always begin again. So just sitting quietly together just for a couple of minutes.